are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Don't worry about it. I got plenty of time to talk. It's my executive time. No, I didn't even give a shit about the speech. I just want to know that Frankie girl didn't win for Smilf. She was the only one who was above a 7 in the whole crew.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Kimberly Melman Orozco, Professor of Criminology at George Mason University, author of Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. Meanwhile, 2 weeks away from a government shutdown, will Democrats stand up for Dreamers?
Probably not.
And as Trump implodes, executive time blossoms. Meanwhile, New Jersey bans the book A New Jim Crow, and New York prisons impose insane package restrictions. And as schools and water and power problems continue in Puerto Rico, the Koch brothers spend wads of cash to blunt Puerto Rican votes in Florida. SEC investigating Kushner's family over visas. Steve Bannon seems to have blown it big time, big time, bigly. Trump administration booting 200,000 El Salvadorans out of the country after over a decade of living in this country. And the Trump administration really, really wants to hide Election Integrity Commission documents from a former Election Integrity Committee member. Wonder why. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, welcome. It is another Monday, and we're still here. No major nuclear confrontation over the weekend. That was good. Lots of just insanity as we warm up to having Congress return, and we'll see if they are able to inflict more damage on this country as we go forward. Just an update on, I don't know, I'm just going to do these as they come through and we see one or two of these stories. After, in the wake of the Republican tax scam, people are starting to dig into what the new Paul Ryan's postcard is going to look like. And it basically, there's a lot of addendums apparently to the postcard. There's a full-on worksheet that you reference. It's like one of those things like, here, it's all in a postcard. And then at the bottom it says in fine print, if you need another sheet of paper, that type of thing. But more important than the lies that they told about how they were going to simplify the tax code, this story about Pfizer, I think, is telling. They've announced $10 billion. Is that right? $10 billion worth of stock buybacks, which, of course, is going to enhance the value of the stocks owned by shareholders. But more importantly, for the CEO, who undoubtedly is a major stock as a major shareholder and board of directors. And with all this windfall, they're raising their dividends to 34 cents per share, which is a 6% bump. In other words, all of those monies that were going into, supposedly going to create all these new jobs. They knew it beforehand, but now we're starting to see what is going into this money, those tax cuts for corporations. Because, you know, it's one thing. It was obviously, you've got these massive tax cuts for wealthy people, which is going to increase on the privates, on the personal taxes, going to increase wealth inequality. But these corporate tax cuts are essentially the same thing because they're being passed directly to shareholders. And we're just moving more of the country's wealth into the capital gains tax ledger and into the pockets of the very wealthy. But here's the good news, though. They haven't announced any job increases. However, on the research and development front, which we're told is why you've got to give companies like Pfizer such record profits, they will no longer conduct research and development into finding new drugs to treat Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So we got that going for us.
Ew, Alzheimer's is gross.
Mm-hmm.
Totally gross.
There you go. So that's just, you know, every now and then a little anecdote about how this is going for us in the post-tax scam world. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I am a consumer of Blue Apron and have been since before they became a patron of this show, or a not a patron, but a sponsor. And I don't know, it's possible we have someone from Blue Apron that listens to the show. I'm not sure.
It's possible.
And this is going to go, literally, Nikki said to me the other day, I think I'm going to try this Whole 30 thing. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. And it turns out, like, no sugar, which I think is a good thing. And then there was a lot of other stuff that was sort of tricky. You know, no bread, but other stuff. And I was like, that sounds like we would have to go.
Stuff.
No, but it's one of those things where you have to go and, like, you have to get very specific foods to shop for. And I was like, I'm not involved in that. However, Blue Apron just told us today, for 8 weeks, ending on February 26th, Blue Apron is teaming up with Whole 30 to bring you delicious recipes. It's a diet. It sounds like a fairly healthy diet as far as these things go. Their menu will feature two Whole 30 approved recipes each week, like Mexican spice barramundi. That's a good fish. I've had it from them before. With avocado, togarashi chicken lettuce cups with avocado. I don't know what that means. Kale and sweet potato salad. Delicious. Kickstart your new year with Blue Apron and Whole 30. This is not Whole 30 approved, but we had the other night fried pollock sandwich. It was delicious. I did not have any of the bread. Myla and Nikki did. Saul ate it. He loved it. I mean, he's a big fish sticks guy anyways, but we made it home. It was super easy and it was delicious. Convenience and variety. That's what Blue Apron delivers. Fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked under 45 minutes. Also had a chicken with noodles dish that was pretty amazing last week. The menu changes every week based on... That's the only thing I can remember now. It's like what Blue Apron meal I had a week ago. Everything else sort of goes out the door. Flexibility. Blue Apron offers
totally
12
true.
New recipes each week. Customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what fits their schedule. You don't need to get, you can choose. I'll take it on, I'll get it on Wednesday. We'll have it with Wednesday and Thursday, whatever it is. It's high quality. Blue Apron sends only high quality ingredients, meat with no added hormones. Blue Apron is treating Majority Report listeners right now to their first 3 meals, $30 value, with your first order if you visit blueapron.com/majority. Check out this week's menu. Get your $30 off with free shipping at blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Well, that's the other thing. It takes about 45 minutes. All the ingredients are there. You can involve the kids. I mean, you've heard all this from me before, but it's still eat it. It's delicious. Oh, okay. Yeah, this is the big clip that people are talking about. And as things get more and more weird coming out of the... And that's really the only word for it now, right? It's just like weird.
It's weird, Mike.
And horrible. Horrible,
yeah, I would
and
say
weird.
Grotesque would be my word.
Steve Bannon seems to be in a very bad place. And one of his guys on the inside...
A new bad place.
A new bad place. I'm saying within Steve Bannon's perspective.
Right.
Bad for him.
Right. From his perspective, he's in a bad place.
Jew.
For all of us, he's actually in the best place he's been in probably in a long time.
Right.
So you'll remember one of the last vestiges of the lunatic fringe, as opposed to just the morally decrepit, in the White House, is Stephen Miller. And he apparently is the last one who's going out there now, totally debasing himself to maintain himself in good graces.
I have to quibble a little bit there, too. I don't think it's possible for him to debase himself.
That's true.
But anyway, sorry.
That's true. Here he is trying to justify the tweets that came out of the White House this weekend, which included what, like, I'm a genius, I'm totally
stable. A very
stable.
Stable genius, and I'm like a very smart person, which I resent because I say that every day myself.
And here's
Stephen
Miller. Could
you imagine actually typing that out? Like, you can accidentally say any number of things.
I should tell people.
But you look at it on your screen and you're like very smart. There it is.
I feel like I got to remind people I'm totally stable. And here's Stephen Miller coming in to remind Jake Tapper that he's also totally stable.
And he said, quote, actually, throughout my life, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being like really smart. Crooked Hillary Clinton also played these cards very hard and, as everyone knows, went down in flames. I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to president of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that. Do you think tweets like that help or hurt the cause that the president is stable and up for the job?
Not only do I think they help it, but I think in the toxic environment that you've created here in CNN and cable news, which is a real crisis of legitimacy for your network, and we saw it, of course, with the extremely fake news you reported about the Don Jr. and WikiLeaks story. There was a huge embarrassment for your network.
Stephen.
Just like the huge embarrassment you had when you got the Comey testimony wrong.
Stephen, I'm trying to get to the issue of the president's fitness, which a lot of people
are questioning. Well, I'm getting to the issue of your fitness, but the president's tweets absolutely reaffirmed the plan.
Pause it. At this point, he really does. It will put the lotion in the tweet. It will put the lotion in the tweet.
Truth. A self-made billionaire revolutionized reality TV. And
pause it. Hold on. Wait a second. Let's just sit and marinate in that for a moment. He revolutionized reality TV, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my God. That little freak is nailing it.
And I did it. I did it as talent. That never happens. Like the last time reality TV was revolutionized, it was a producer.
Usually it's a producer.
It was a producer. I mean, I obviously had a producer credit. But I mean,
I
just did it as talent. For his talent.
Okay. Revolutionized reality TV. And tap into something magical that's happening in the hearts of this country. The people that you
the
don't
has approval rating in the 30s. I don't know what magical you're talking
people,
about.
The people that you don't connect with and understand, the people whose manufacturing jobs have left, who've been besieged by high crime communities, and who've been affected by a policy of uncontrolled immigration, those voices, those experiences don't get covered on this network. That's why, to prove the point, I was booked to talk about the very issues I'm just
Where's
describing.
The rewind
you're
button.
Not even asking
this is
about
great.
Because they're not interesting facts to you.
That's not true. I have plenty of questions on immigration. You've attempted to filibuster by talking about your flights.
No,
to the
I'm
president.
Not. No,
I want to ask
a
you a question because
but don't
you,
no,
you,
don't
you,
be
you,
condescending, you, Jake. Jake.
Stephen.
Jake.
The president
reason,
and the
no,
White House.
The reason why I
want to
talk about
the president and the White House.
The reason why I want to talk about the president's experiences, what I've seen with him traveling to meet dozens of foreign leaders, with his incredible work.
Okay, you're not answering the questions.
No,
I understand.
You have 24 hours a day of anti-Trump material,
you're
not going to give 3 minutes for the American people
I get
to hear
it.
The real experience
of
Donald Trump.
There's one viewer that you care about right now, and you're being obsequious,
no,
you're being
which,
a factotum
no,
in order
being,
to please him, okay?
No.
And I think
you know,
I've
you know
wasted
who I,
it.
Care
I think
about?
I've wasted enough of my
you
viewers'
know who
time.
I, you know who
Thank
I care
you,
about?
As Republicans,
Jake,
lawmakers
you
call
know
for
who
Attorney
I care
General
about?
Jeff Sessions to resign in a major reversal, Democrats are now coming to his defense. What changed? We'll ask the top Democrats.
What does factotum mean?
Wow.
Factotum.
Tapper is so bitchy.
That was good.
I love that bitch face.
That was
and I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to leave early again. I'm sick. I'm physically ill from looking at that guy's face again.
And apparently the word is that, I mean, obviously they cut off Miller's microphone at one point, and I think they may have physically escorted him off the set and out of the studio.
Jake, don't be condescending. Don't be condescending.
Yeah, Jake sort of did what I read is he just sort of did a thanks for coming sort of thing, and Miller didn't get the point. And Tapper also said, this is why nobody has you on TV.
There you go.
Well, that's how you handle it.
I mean, I know as far as the mainstream media goes, it's kind of a Jason versus Freddy situation as far as I'm concerned, but I still love that bitch face. Can't help it.
Well, I would also say that should not be the only reason why they don't have him on TV. Right? Like if you can kick people off because they don't play by the medium rules on some level, how about kicking them off because they're just patented liars? Like, I mean, obvious liars.
Yeah, good luck covering this administration. Sure.
What fun is that? He has to have him on so then he can kick him off again.
Well, that's exactly why Michael Wharf is perfect for this moment. All of these people hand-wringing about him, he's like exactly who should be covering these people. He's unethical and gossip-obsessed. Perfect.
Yep. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Kimberly Melman Orozco about her book, Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the program Professor of Criminology from George Mason University and author of Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium, Kimberly Melman Orozco. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with how you, what was from a, I guess from an academic perspective, or what was it that drew you to this topic in the context of criminology?
Well, as a graduate student, I thought that I was very well versed in current issues and topics that were affecting our country and our communities. And I just, through happenstance, took a class by Dr. Louise Shelley, who's one of the leading scholars and academics on anti-trafficking research. And it was just really shocking to me to learn that slavery still existed and, in fact, was more prevalent than it had ever been before, and that we still had people being exploited and forced and defrauded and coerced into situations of modern day slavery. And it was just very shocking to me that I hadn't heard about it before. And that coming to find that a lot of these criminals were being met with pretty much impunity with our criminal justice system, and victims were being erroneously criminalized and denied services. It was just really a shock to the conscious, and it was something that really motivated me to look further into the issue and identify evidence-based ways to address this crime and protect victims and prosecute offenders.
Well, when you say that that slavery could be at its peak, like what are we talking about within this country, and what are we talking about? Just we're talking about specifically in this country trafficked slaves. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, as an evidence-based researcher, I'm reticent to cite any statistics because of the clandestine nature of the crime. I've heard people throw around numbers in the hundreds of thousands, but in reality, we don't have any hard statistics on the number of people who are being victimized. Now, with that being said, in my book, each chapter talks about the different forms of human trafficking that we see in the United States and the products that we see used by Americans that are produced through slave labor. So, for example, you have domestic sex trafficking, domestic servitude, human trafficking and slavery within the agricultural industry, as far as products that we use, the chocolate that we eat, the agricultural farms that produce tomatoes or the citrus groves of Florida. There have been human trafficking, slavery type of situations found in each of those industries. You have gang-controlled sex trafficking. Various forms of labor trafficking can include door-to-door salespeople, which was something that was shocking to me. But people are being exploited. They are being enslaved in the sense that they are not being paid for their work, or they're being paid well under what we would expect them to. They do face physical abuse, sexual abuse. And I think it's more clandestine than it was before. It's a little bit more hidden. And it's just manifested in different ways, but it still exists, and it is more prevalent than it has ever been.
Okay, so you spent a lot of time talking to both people who are basically trafficked, enslaved in many respects, both in the traffickers and in the consumers that end up, I guess, you know, exploiting these exploited people. Let's start with those that you spoke to who are trafficked. Like, give us a sense of, I mean, is there a specific geographic location that people who are trafficked are coming from? Demographic, gender, what is there any through lines here? Or just give us a sense of some that you spoke to that are indicative of this instance.
Well, at least in my research, I find that persons who are trafficked can come from all walks of life. However, there are certain populations who are at high risk. So, for example, marginalized individuals, victims of abuse as children, persons who are of the lower socioeconomic demographic, they can be at high risk. But human traffickers, the way that they target people is basically just looking for a void in somebody's life. And so the way that I set it up in my book is looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So at the very base level, we all are searching to meet our basic physiological needs. So food, shelter, water, so on and so forth. So, for example, a child who might be housing insecure or food insecure or might be a runaway or homeless, they could be at risk for a trafficker pulling them into an exploited situation by making the false promise to fulfill those basic fundamental needs. At the higher levels, we have we search for safety and love and belonging and esteem, self-esteem. And so a human trafficker might look at somebody who might come from a higher socioeconomic background, who might have low self-esteem or not have that sense of love and belonging, and he might make the false promise to fulfill those basic needs. Or self-actualization, making false promises is to, you know, provide them economic opportunities to fulfill their dreams, whether they want to be an actress or a singer or a model, whatever the case may be. They're pretty much just creating a false narrative to put them in an exploited situation. So, for example, a migrant coming from one country to another, you know, giving them an economic opportunity, but once they arrive, you know, those economic opportunities that were promised are no longer available, and they're in an enslaved type of situation, working off a visa debt, so on and so forth. So pretty much, I mean, the population that I've interviewed, they have traversed different backgrounds, different demographics. Everybody's at risk, but I think there are certain populations that are definitely at higher risk than others.
All right. Well, I mean, so give me, just a specific example, case studies, because I'm curious. I mean, I think most people, when they think of people who are being enslaved or trafficked, either perceive someone who is here without documentation, or someone who is here with documentation that is controlled by an employer, right? And you write about this as well. What about? I mean, I want to hear a case study or two of each of those, if there are any that stand out for you. But I'm also curious as to situations where do we have domestic trafficking?
Absolutely. I mean, we definitely have persons who are trafficked, who are American citizens, and that are trafficked within our own borders. And to give you a concrete example or an anecdote of that type of trafficking, I live in Northern Virginia, and one of the victims who I rescued, I witnessed her being victimized, being beaten at 1:30 in the afternoon on a Friday in front of Springfield Mall in Virginia. And so I write about this in a chapter of my book. I saw the man who was the driver throw her out, throw luggage at her. He ended up leaving. Long story short, this woman who was in her 30s, I picked her up and got to know her and got her narrative and got her situated in a safe space. But it turns out that she had been trafficked on and off for nearly 20 years. Her first sex trafficker was actually her mother's drug dealer. She had been trafficked on and off and at times went to seek help, but sometimes she was arrested. So one of the headlines of one of the times that she was victimized, it says prostitute calls police on pimp. And at one point she was even shot at point blank range in the leg by one of her sex traffickers. She was shot in the leg requiring a vascular transfusion, but no one was ever arrested. The sex trafficker who I saw victimizing was actually down here in Virginia from the Northeast on a pretrial release for a malicious wounding against another one of his sex trafficking victims. But that charge was eventually dropped when the victim could no longer be located. So this woman, I mean, she was a U.S. born citizen, but she had been sex trafficked. I mean, she had never known a conventional romantic relationship. They've always been sex traffickers who have used her, exploited her, abused her, and there were just so many missed opportunities for her rescue. So that's a concrete example of domestic sex trafficking. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we do have a number of people coming into the country without documentation. So given the militarization of our southern border, a lot more people are relying on smugglers. Over 90% of undocumented migrants are using smugglers. They're paying those smugglers between $5,000 to $10,000 to come to the United States. But when you're relying on an illicit organized crime group to migrate you from one country to another, that group actually might be involved in human trafficking as well. So oftentimes what we'll see is once that undocumented migrant gets to the United States, they were deceived on the nature of the job that they're going to be provided, the compensation, or even just the migration fees will go from $10,000 to $20,000, and they'll be put in an indentured servitude type of situation. So those are two, I guess, case study type of examples of human trafficking that you will see within the United States.
And in that latter example, I mean, we're basically talking about sort of, I guess, some type of blackmail, right? And that I would imagine also, if you have people who came into the country with a working visa or a visa or a guest working type of situation, we're looking at blackmail. If you don't work this, you know, if you don't work for me for free, or working off, you know, theoretically you're working off your what you owe me, I'm going to turn you into the authorities. Is that basically what it is? I mean, it seems like it's either a financial or I guess emotional blackmail on some level.
I don't know if I would call it blackmail per se, but I mean, it is that they do have, I guess, a type of collateral. They are holding on to something that is of great importance to these undocumented individuals, but it's not just undocumented persons. So for example, in my book, I talk about the trafficking of legal immigrants. So legal non-immigrants who are coming to our country on temporary visas as guest workers, we know that the employer holds an incredible amount of discretion and authority over them, holds on to sometimes their paperwork, houses them in deplorable conditions, sometimes will give them drugs to help them work longer and keep them indebted. So it's definitely an indentured servitude type of situation that does affect both undocumented populations, but also persons who come into the country legally as well. So I definitely think that they have some power and discretion that has not been addressed within our immigration policies, and that needs to be looked at with greater scrutiny, because it's something that we do see quite often.
Well, give us a profile of the traffickers. I mean, I know you spoke to a lot of traffickers, and you found them surprisingly, I guess, I don't know what the word would encompass it, but they were not as the caricatures that one might expect.
Absolutely. So, I mean, initially, when I talk to my students or make presentations, I talk about, I guess, the typical narrative of a human trafficking situation. A lot of people think of the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, where you have a clearly innocent victim, and you have the bad guys that are, you know, gun-wielding Albanian mobsters that are just kind of using brute force or drugging these girls and kidnapping them, and that's what they think of when they envision a human trafficking situation. The reality is that a skilled and or experienced human trafficker is able to coerce and deceive and actually convince their victim using words or coercion or deception into an exploitable situation. And so one of the things that I found in my interviews is that these men were extremely intelligent and charismatic. They were chameleons in the sense that they can sort of weave their way into interacting on par with their conversants. So when they saw that I was a PhD academic, they tried to flex their intellectual muscle by quoting great philosophers from memory, telling me how some of them spoke four languages, and just really trying to show me how smart they were, because that's what they thought would appeal to my senses. So they can sort of manipulate how they interact depending on their victim or who their target is. And they were just incredibly kind, and they appeared to be genuine, portrayed themselves as lovers and Casanovas and heroes, when in reality, pretty much every word out of their mouth is deception and kind of trying to lead their victim into a predetermined exploitable situation. And so that was one of the things that was really shocking to me, and I think most people really take for granted. They think that they would be able to discern the bad guy, the human trafficker, from somebody who's not trying to exploit them, and being able to tell the difference, it's not so easy. And that's actually one of the reasons why I serve as an expert witness in human trafficking cases, is to bridge that knowledge gap for juries and judges and to show them what human trafficking actually looks like.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what happens when these type of cases go to court? I mean, are court systems are they set up to handle these type of cases? Do we have talk about it in terms of the courts before we get to statutes?
Well, I mean, this is something that I've written about at length, and it's something that's featured in my book as well. One of the things that was surprising to me, you see a lot of stories about human trafficking arrests and rescues, right? So you have the FBI, Operation Cross Country. This is how many people we arrested, how many people we rescued, and a lot of people trying to brag about those accomplishments for public accolade. But in reality, if you actually trace those cases back to, if you follow them to conviction or dismissal, a lot of these guys are getting their case dismissed, or they're pleading to tangentially related crimes that carry very little punishment. So a great example of that is the story of Peach Therapy. If you Google Peach Therapy, there are tons of Washington Post stories about this erotic massage parlor that was trafficking women from, I believe, South Korea into New York, and from New York to my childhood suburb of Annandale, Virginia. And I mean, they were talking about this was a human trafficking arrest, but the proprietor eventually only was, she was convicted, but she was only sentenced to, I think, 3 years in federal prison and a couple $100,000 fine. And 3 months after she was convicted, Washington Post reporter Tom Jackman went to that establishment, and there a woman in hot pants and heavy makeup answered the door, and it was still up and running. I mean, it was had a different name, same building, same phone number, still men claiming to have received sexual services. And to this day, they're still posting in the Women for Men dating section of Backpage.com. So, you know, behind the headlines, if you're looking at how these cases pan out in the courtroom, you see a lot of plea bargains with slap on the hand type of sentences. When I serve as an expert witness on cases, I try to bridge the credibility gap of victims and educate the jurors and judges. And so, you know, every once in a while, you do see human trafficking convictions that do have a punishment that's equivalent to the severity of the crime. For example, Carlos Curtis sex trafficked a 12-year-old girl from New York to D.C., and he was the first person sentenced to life in prison for sex trafficking a minor. So you do see that every once in a while, but that's the exception, not the norm.
And before we get into sort of statutory stuff and what you think will and will not work, but you also interviewed consumers of, I guess, it's mostly, I mean, I guess many of us are consumers of this slave product, but the most obvious are ones who are going as sex consumers. Give us a sense of like what the different profiles of consumers of slave labor essentially look like.
You hit the nail on the head there in the sense that one of the things I talk about or I'll say is that we all of us in the United States have used, consumed, touched a product of slavery in our lives. But with regards to the commercial sex industry, I've done a lot of interviews with commercial sex consumers. Most of them don't think that they're purchasing services from sex trafficked victims, but I've also determined that they really have a difficult time discerning a consenting sex worker from somebody who's sex trafficked, as do most people. But with that being said, the demographic, at least in the DC metropolitan area, I mean, these guys are professionals. They are well-educated. I've interviewed a former journalist, a JD, somebody who's currently a PhD economics professor. He began purchasing commercial sex services after his wife contracted cancer and lost her sex drive. They are normal people that have regular professions and are rather educated, which was shocking to me. They're not just kind of, you know, some seedy guy that's hanging out in the back alley. Most of them are professionals, they're family men, and they're kind of what's fueling the demand for the commercial sex industry.
Well, what is the reaction of someone like that who... Or I should say, let me start it this way. How do they not know? How do they react if they find out that they're going to, I guess, a brothel going on Backpage.com and ordering a prostitute? I mean, what happens when they become aware of the fact that, oh, they're dealing with slaves?
Well, a lot of the guys, actually, they would, at least what they say is that they would not purchase sex services if they knew this, that somebody was a victim. And they've talked about instances where they've suspected that somebody was a victim, and they didn't report it to the police, obviously, because of their self-interest. They didn't want to be criminalized, but they did not return. They did not go back to that place. And some claim to have tried to pay or purchase the freedom of these sex trafficked women. Now, whether that's true or not, I can't tell, just because of the lack of information in the clandestine nature of the crime. However, I do believe a lot of them would not knowingly purchase commercial sex services from somebody who's sex trafficked. With that being said, they really do turn a blind eye to a lot of risk factors. For example, sex tourists from the United States will travel overseas, and a lot of them, especially in Asian countries, have noted and commented on how a lot of the women have scars or burn marks on them, and they just kind of assume, oh, maybe it's a violent boyfriend or, you know, something else is going on. They don't consider that they're being sex trafficked or held against their will, because during the act and before and after the act, this woman's putting on, you know, a show. She's putting on a happy face. She's not asking for help. And that's one of the things we see in the courtroom as well. You know, you encountered other people. Why didn't you call the police? Why didn't you run away? He wasn't in the room with you at all times. They don't understand that it's mostly mental manipulation, coercion, deception. And there's more of a virtual tether than a physical chain binding these women to their abuser. So I think it really depends on the man, the situation, but I do know a lot of them have discontinued purchasing commercial sex services from a particular agency or person based off of suspicions of trafficking.
I mean, based upon your experience as an expert witness, how do juries, how do courts react to that concept that you can be psychologically trapped versus, you know, that dynamic of like, you could have said something to somebody and you could have, you know, escaped there. I mean, I ask just because, like, we have, you know, just the first thing that pops in my head is how many cops we see who shoot either a perpetrator or just someone they've rolled up on based upon what was in the cop's brain as to whether or not this person posed a risk. And there's sort of just it's just taken for granted that, well, if they feel there was a risk, then there was a risk. I wonder if there's a similar dynamic or not with the victims of sex trafficking and trafficking broadly speaking.
Absolutely. I mean, in my experience, I've gone down to what's called the track in Washington, D.C., and the track is essentially a few block area on the street where women are being sold for sex. They're being sold in D.C. between hours of 4 and 6 a.m. And I've gone down there to conduct systematic social observations. And I've seen these women, you know, walking the block, literally wearing thongs or G-strings and bikini tops and high heels. And it's really kind of unquestionable what they're out there doing. I've seen the men coming by and picking them up in a variety of mid-grade to luxury vehicles. And I've also seen the police come by, and the police generally just will shine a light on them and tell them to get off the street. And as soon as they turn the corner, the women are back out. I've actually stopped and spoken to a DC police officer and asked him, you know, do you consider that some of these women might be sex trafficked? Because I, for one, noticed that in addition to the women out there, there were men watching their every move for a lot of them. There were men in very nice cars, nice clothes, that were presumably their domestic sex trafficker, their pimp, watching their every move and really controlling what they did. And the police officer, at least that I spoke to, he did not consider that they were not there consensually. He thought that that's what they wanted to do, and that they were there on their own free will, and said, you know, well, sex trafficking is handled by vice. That's not what we work with. So we definitely do have some tunnel vision about what a sex trafficking victim looks like. And one of the problems with that is a lot of the materials that are being disseminated, for example, by the Blue Campaign and the federal government, show a victim as somebody who's, like, physically, you can tell they're being beaten, that they're being chained to a bed. And that's not what sex trafficking looks like. So I definitely think that when I serve as an expert witness, I don't know, and I haven't polled, done an exit poll of jurors, but I see a lot of heads nodding and really kind of like the look of a light bulb going off when they say, oh, well, that makes sense. That's how one man can control six different women simultaneously. That's why they didn't run away. That's why they didn't call the police. That's why for years they seemed, from the outside looking in, seemed to be complacent to their own exploitation, is because they had developed a trauma bond, and they were being psychologically manipulated and coerced and deceived into that situation. So when they're educated, I think, and become aware of this phenomenon, I think it makes sense. But I think there's a long way to go to really train law enforcement on what this crime looks like, and also how they can have a successful intervention when they suspect that that's what's going on.
Okay, so beyond that, What from a statutory level is happening that is unhelpful, and what could be helpful?
Well, one of the biggest or most hotly debated pieces of legislation right now is called the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. And basically what this piece of legislation proposes to do is they want to be able to go after websites where commercial sex is sold, namely Backpage.com. Backpage.com has been vilified for about 10 years, pretty much since Craigslist shut down their erotic and adult sections on their website. But both of them are classified advertisement websites, and they're planning on being able to open up the current policies to allow for civil litigation and prosecution of websites where this these commercial sex advertisements are hosted. Now, most anti-trafficking advocates and victims and survivors and police, outward facing, they're going to tell you that this is a great piece of legislation and that's going to help reduce sex trafficking, specifically child sex trafficking. So there's a lot of symbolism behind it and not a lot of legislative opposition. I'm coming from an evidence-based perspective, and I'm telling you right now that that legislation will have absolutely no effect on the prevalence of sex trafficking. In fact, what it will do, and there is evidence to suggest, it's going to displace those commercial sex advertisements and push them further underground. Right now, because of the work that I do and my familiarity with law enforcement tactics, I know that Backpage is being used as the key catalyst for rescues and arrests. So the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they'll cite to you, they'll say 73% of our child sex trafficking cases come from Backpage.com. Wow. And they use that to say, to try to draw a causal link or a correlation between the two. But I'm saying, but as a researcher, I feel very strongly that that's an ecological fallacy. The reason why that statistic is so high is because Backpage is an open access website. Everybody knows about it. Law enforcement and victim service providers actively troll those websites and patrol them and look for potential cases of exploitation that are reported to the police. And the police set up fake advertisements there. And it's really kind of, it's being used as a tool for law enforcement. What I do know is that I have seen barely any articles about Humanaplex.com or AlwaysOnTheHunt.com or Eros.com or theeroticreview.com, or any of the many other websites that are also used for the sale of commercial sex services. And you don't want to displace all of those advertisements to a variety of websites because it's going to be difficult, more difficult to patrol and to look for arrests and rescues. In addition, you can displace it to password protected or secret websites. So another great example, remember earlier in the segment, I had mentioned the PhD economics professor who purchases commercial sex services. He doesn't go on Backpage.com. He belongs to a secret Facebook group. And that's where he purchased, that's through peer-to-peer referral, and that's how he purchased the sex services. Mm. That's not something that police can search for that I'm going to be aware of or gain access to. It's something that is more difficult to patrol and identify cases for intervention.
So I'm
against that legislation.
Okay. And because basically it's sort of show horse type of legislation. And it's even worse than that in some ways, because it inhibits any access, any sort of, I guess, I don't want to say transparency, but it's the least opaque of all the ways in which you track down victims of trafficking. What about the notion of decriminalizing or legalizing the sex work in general? What is, from a remedy standpoint of a trafficking issue, I mean, what is your perspective on that debate?
Well, first, it's very important to differentiate legalization from decriminalization. Legalization would essentially, you know, make the act permissible, regulated, and legally allowed. An example of that would be the FKK clubs in Germany. I am not in support of legalization because it creates what I consider and what research has actually supported a protective veneer. So basically, people are still being trafficked from other countries or within their own country. But now you have the veneer of legalization to say, oh, well, this isn't sex trafficking. This isn't something that's an illicit activity. She's here consensually. And you don't have people looking into whether she is being a woman or man is being manipulated or coerced or exploited in that situation, or it's more difficult to look into it. So, for example, you know, looking at the women that are working in the FKK clubs in Germany, from men who have received services there, they do suspect that some of those women are being sex trafficked, even though it is, quote unquote, the commercial sex industry is legal. Aside from that, there is decriminalization. Now, decriminalization means that the act is still illegal, but the penalties are less, or police officers are more able to use discretion when and if they choose to cite somebody or find them guilty or cite them or arrest them for a particular crime. I am in support of decriminalization, as is Amnesty International. And the reason being is that it is so difficult, you know, at first blush to discern a consenting sex worker from a sex trafficked victim. And because of that difficulty, you end up erroneously arresting victims often. Victims often report being arrested over and over again for prostitution-related crimes. It undermines their trust with law enforcement, their inclination to cooperate with investigations, and it really does hurt, you know, our ability to actually go after the bad guy. So I am in support of decriminalizing sex workers and say, you know, and empowering them to come forward when and if they are a victim of a serious crime. And I don't think that is in anyone's best interest to further criminalize them and keep these crimes clandestine.
I'm not clear on what the downside is of legalization. I mean, I think your argument, obviously, of decriminalization makes a lot of sense, but it seems to me you get in a legalization framework, you have the decriminalization benefits, but you also then have perhaps regimes for protection of sex workers and some mechanism to ensure who enters into the business, theoretically controlling the organization, you know, the capital in this instance.
Well, I mean, I think logically we would assume as much. So that's what's called a replacement effect, right? So the idea is that if you legalize the commercial sex industry, the legal aspect of the industry is going to replace the illicit sex trafficking and whatnot. What research has shown in places that do legalize the commercial sex industry, they see an expansion effect in the sense that sex trafficking industries end up expanding and increasing in those areas because it undermines law enforcement ability to investigate those types of crimes. And it one of the things that complicates it is the fact that victims, so again, in a legalized situation, you would assume, okay, well, as soon as a legal sex worker's rights are abridged, she's going to go to law enforcement. That's not what happens. And what actually happens is it's usually law enforcement or victim service providers investigating and really kind of providing trauma-informed care before that person is willing to cooperate with law enforcement and actually come out against their victimizer. And so I would be in support of that position or that approach, but the research has shown that sex trafficking actually increases in places where commercial sex is legalized. And that's why I can't support it in good conscience.
Huh. I mean, is that a function of prices go up and so it creates a sort of a black market? Or are you saying that enforcement goes down because resources are not devoted to that sector, if you will? Or is it both of those things?
I think it could be a little bit of both. I think that there is more research that's needed. We know that more of the what. We know that impact and that effect. We don't necessarily know the why at present. So I think that there's more research needed in that area, but I think it could be both of those things.
People are sort of comparing the Swedish model of decriminalization with the New Zealand model. Are you familiar with that dynamic? I'm curious your perspective on it, if you are.
I'm not well versed in the dynamic, but I do know that it has to do with legalization versus decriminalization, and also whether you're decriminalizing only for the sex workers or for the sex workers as well as the consumers. I am of the opinion that we can expand decriminalization to commercial sex consumers, especially if they're reporting instances of suspected sex trafficking. So as I had mentioned, there are a number of commercial sex consumers who would not in good conscience purchase commercial sex services from somebody who was trafficked. And they actually have remarked on instances where they wish they could have gone to the police, but, you know, for their own fear or self-preservation, they did not do that. I think if we decriminalized it in the sense of saying, okay, if you are aware of a sex worker who is being victimized or being trafficked, and you come forward with that information to the authorities or to the police, we are not going to criminalize you. We are not going to arrest you as long as you're reporting a crime.
Broadly speaking, are we making any progress on this? I mean, has there been any progress? I mean, it seems like the problem of it has increased through the years, which I would imagine. I mean, and I'm not sure what that's a function of, but have we made any progress in this regard?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you measure progress. I think people's awareness of the concept of human trafficking has increased. However, if you're looking at the goals outlined by our federal legislation, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is to prevent new crimes, prosecute offenders, protect victims, and develop partnerships between private and federal and state level governments and entities to combat trafficking, I think that we have a very long way to go. And in fact, I don't think there's a lot of research being done to evaluate the efficacy of our efforts. We don't even have a baseline to measure how prevalent this criminal phenomenon is, much less whether it's decreasing. And so I think that there needs to be more research and really looking at where we're spending our money. I think there's a lot of duplication of efforts that could be reallocated. So, for example, I mean, we have the federal trafficking hotline, state hotlines, local hotlines, and I mean, also 911 and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's hotline, and so many people, you know, being funded to provide hotlines, but they're really a duplication of efforts that really don't do very much. I think that money could be reallocated elsewhere. And a really key area that's in need of funding is the provision of services post-rescue. We know that after a victim is quote-unquote rescued, there's often a lack of residential placement, trauma-informed therapy, and other forms of care, vocational training. So after they're rescued, there really isn't much for them, and they find themselves re-victimized or re-criminalized by and large.
Professor Kimberly Melman Orozco, the book is Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. One thing you can do, by coincidence, as this is the time of the program where I say this, fair trade goods are one way of nearly ensuring that at least your product is not being brought to you by slave trade or slaves, and we offer a deal on justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Coupon code majority, get 10% off. Fair trade all the way through, folks. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half. A reminder, you can become a member of this program and support its daily free show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also, if you want to just do a one-off donation, you can do that there as well. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Jane McAlevey will be on. Former union organizer, now just organizer. I think probably, I don't know how she would define herself in that regard. And on Wednesday, I believe Matt Taibbi is going to come and talk about his Eric Garner book. So if you want to support this program, join themajorityreport.com. Also, tomorrow night, TMBS, The Michael Brooks Show, will be on. I'll tell you tomorrow who's going to be on that. 646-257-3920. Oh, hey, folks, you know, a lot of people, I realize, don't know that we have a free app. It is, right now, the only way to IM the show. It is also the best way to listen to the show live, because you can listen to it in your car live or whatnot. And you can also listen to the podcast. You can listen to both the member feed or the free feed. If you're a member, you just log in. It gives you access. A little menu will pop up and say, do you want the archives? It's not loading every show onto your phone. It's just loading every link onto your phone, and you can search it. It's one of the best ways to search through our archives is to do it on the app. So go to majorityapp.com and get the free iPhone or Android app. Why wouldn't you do that? And soon we're going to have notification features are going to return, and you'll be able to opt out if you don't want to hear from us. We don't get crazy about it, just because who's got the time to send messages?
It's a good app, dude.
And we're going to be doing an update soon. Kyle is going to put all the new graphic stuff. We're going to get new graphics and
short.
I don't know why he. I don't know why that guy showed up for that.
Well, we'll see.
All right, we'll see you in the fun half.